Hello everyone and welcome to Sports Community Podcast, downloaded all around the world, over 60,000 times now in Australia, hosted at the beautiful studios of RPPFM on the Mornington Peninsula in Victoria, 98.7, 98.3 FM on your dial. Welcome to the show. We love having you. On behalf of myself, Joe Novella, and the man who sits next to me, the boss, the head honcho of Sports Community, his name is Mr. Steve Pallas. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thanks, Joe. It's great to be here. Yeah, no, a couple of weeks without any travel around the country. I hope to get to,
very rare.
Hope to get to Christmas without any more travel. But I fear, and I'm very hopeful that I may have one to sneak in one more trip to maybe Adelaide, which may or may not coincide with one said Adelaide Test match, but we'll wait and see whether that happens, and then we'll wait and see if we survive the negotiations with the with my dear, well, not so much my wife, she's very supportive, but my at least two of my three daughters would not be keen to see me get on another plane.
Now, we've got a fantastic guest, Mark Williamson, who's the race director of one of the premier events in Australia, if not the world, the Lawn Pier to Pub open water swim, one of the biggest in the world, and he's going to be on the show a little bit later on. We're also going to go over some grants and just general sports news. But before that, I just want to touch on the success of our podcasts. Of course, none of it would have happened without the support, the generous support, I must add, of the RPPFM studio and board of management and crew here on RPPFM 98.7, 98.3. But as of the last couple of days, we've been downloaded over 60,000 times in Australia and around the world, which is an amazing statistic that we can be very proud of, Steve.
Well, it's great, and we're getting feedback from wherever we go now around the country about the show and different ways that we can improve it and the value that we're adding to people. So one of the ways that you can give us your feedback is by sending us an email at jointheshow@sportscommunity.com.au. And if anyone can think, I mean, we're going to have Mark Williamson on the show talking about the Lawn Pier to Pub 1.2 kilometre open water swim. If anyone can think of an event that can rival that for an outstanding community event, please let us know, because we'd like to talk to them, because as you'll hear from the interview with Mark, it's an amazing event with kind of 20 to 30,000 people on the shore, 5,000 people in the water, and an amazing event done by a relatively small community. So we'll stay tuned to that one. But Joe, as we're winding down towards the end of the year with last week of November now, topical, the grants, there's just a couple that have opened up. One in the Commonwealth Bank Cricket Club sponsorship grant. So for any cricket club around the country, you can apply to Commonwealth Bank for a grant up to $2,000 and per year, which will also include some equipment and some merchandise and also a marquee. So Commonwealth Bank Club Cricket Club sponsorships are now open. And if you're a Victorian club, then Vic Sporting Uniform Grant of up to $1,000 is open. It's just open, Joe. I think it's just opened on the 25th of November and it closes on the 5th of February. So if you're a Victorian sporting club that has uniforms, then get on board. Now, get on board. Go to the Sports Community website, www.sportscommunity.com.au. Click on the Grants tab and you'll see that there's about 50 or 60 grants that are open. And we say that about every week, but the number of grants are opening and shutting all the time. So either go to the website, or the other thing you can do, Joe, to make sure that you don't miss out on a grant at all, is to subscribe to the email newsletter. And you can do that from the Sports Community homepage as well. Now, Joe, big week in sport. There's a couple of things I wanted to draw your attention to. First of all, Bowls had the second year of the Australian Premier League, which is effectively 2020 cricket for Lawn Bowls. And I'm not sure whether you saw it on Foxtel, and it was only on pay-per-view. Sorry, it wasn't on pay-per-view, it was on pay TV on Foxtel. It was a bowls green set up looked like to be in the public bar of a club in Brisbane, and it looked to be a really ideal venue for a sporting event. So to the Bowls Australia and all the Bowls crew, congratulations on such a fantastic event and a new innovation to the sport of bowls. We can look forward to seeing the Jack Attack style roll out through the Bowls clubs. So great initiative from Bowls Australia. But the thing that caught my eye during the week, Joe, was the Football Federation Australia. Now you're paying a little bit more attention, aren't you? Football Federation of Australia AGM, where President Frank Lowry spoke about the FFA's whole of football plan. And I think, Joe, listening to the commentators and certainly looking at the wording around what Mr. Lowry said at the AGM, is that Football Federation Australia is now looking at a total plan for football within Australia. So starting at the grassroots sporting clubs, or bringing kids into the game, developing their skills, and then taking them through the elite pathway. So I'm really interested to get your opinion, given that you're a learned student of the game, Joe, that there's been a lot of commentary about the fact that the change to the A-League has been really detrimental to the development of our elite level footballers, because it broke that link, that junior link that was in the old National Soccer League, where the clubs, the soccer league, the National Soccer League clubs, yes, they had the elite teams, but they also had all the way down through to the under 11s, I think it was, and that created a really high quality coaching infrastructure and development infrastructure that was certainly lost in when A-League came about, and is now starting to that infrastructure, not necessarily that structure, but the youth development and player development structure, is now being a significant focus, because we're seeing a struggle at the highest levels of the game, Joe.
Yeah, look, I don't particularly subscribe to that view. It was made popular by Mark Viduka, who's one of our most famous footballers to ever wear the green and gold jersey. He, during the last couple of weeks, has lamented the poor showing of the Socceroos. But I think that basically the Socceroos are in a development stage, and they've made the World Cup finals. They also have been able to, Ange Postecoglou, the coach, has been able to promote record numbers of domestic league players into that Socceroos squad, whereas we've relied heavily on international players in the past. So I think our development paths are quite healthy, and I think we're heading in the right direction with the development paths through the NPL, or the high performance leagues in each of the states. So yeah, I'm not a subscriber to that view. I think we're on the right track. I mean, critics would point to the fact that we've only won two in the last 12 internationals, but we've played some big heavy hitters in that time. We are in development, and I'm quite confident that we're going to do quite well in our backyard for the Asian Games and go on to qualify for Russia in 2018. So I'm not in agreement with the legend and some of the commentators around, but then again, you know, I haven't pulled on the green and gold shirt, so my opinion is just one of many out there.
Well, I was listening to an interview, and I respect your opinion, Joe, but I was listening to an interview, and I'm trying on SEN, on the 24-hour sports station that we have the privilege of listening to in Melbourne, from, I'm pretty sure, I missed his name, but I'm pretty sure it was the FFA technical director who really did, it was in, and you're right, it was in response to Mark Viduka's comments, but he actually backed them up 100%. And what he was saying was that if you're not on an A-League list, then the next level of development for you is down at the state league level, and that's just too big a gap. There was very little youth competitions and those sorts of environments where people could develop up to the A-League level and then beyond. So it's interesting. It was highly inflammatory, the comments that Mark Viduka made, but I found it very interesting that FFA, I'm pretty sure it was the technical director, and I should have done a little bit more preparation, Joe, that he was really endorsing those comments. And then I guess the whole of football philosophy, which now Frank Lowry has come out and talked about at the recent AGM, really looks to create a single pathway or a single structure. And just in the last minute before we go to Mark Williamson, Joe, now that the FFA Cup's wound up, how have you seen that with the suburban semi-professional clubs playing against the big boys and acquitting themselves quite well?
Oh, just sensational. It's been a sensational result for that particular competition. Again, there was a lot of critics at the start that said that it wouldn't succeed, but you know, with the fairy tale results of both Bentley Greens and a couple of other squads, and our own Mornington, who got to the later stages of the competition and were eventually knocked out by the Melbourne Knights, who are a state league club of semi-professionals here in Victoria. So it garnered a lot of attention for the sport. Also got on to a national broadcaster and also through live streaming. So it was a fantastic result. You know, I think it's cemented itself in the footballing landscape as a competition that's going to go on from year to year from here on in.
Yeah, Joe, I couldn't agree with you more. And let's be honest, it's been a tried and true method in England a tried and true format in England for a long period of time. But I wonder why other sports don't try the format, because, geez, I would love to be a suburban, you know, competitor of whatever your chosen sport is, and just get the opportunity to go up against the big boys. Well, boys or girls, Joe, the professionals. The professionals. It would be, look, that's one of the things that events like the Lawn Pier to Pub allows, that you can participate in the same events as the professionals and triathlon.
It's a good point, actually, because you can see it almost working in netball. You know, you could have netball is a massive sport, and they could play some of the satellite city clubs are huge. Well, I mean, you do work with Beaconsfield, and they are a massive club.
Oh, absolutely, and I can understand why it wouldn't necessarily be. There would be some health and safety issues potentially where you've got your high impact, high collision sports, because the reality is that the professionals are a lot bigger and stronger than the amateurs, which then creates a risk management issue. But when we're just talking sports of limited contact and, you know, skill and those sorts of things, geez, I reckon that format is really transferable across a whole range of sports. So, Joe, we'll ponder that over the next couple of weeks. But all hats off, all credit to FFA for really continuing to create a holistic approach to the development of football, or soccer as some of us know it, within Australia.
You're listening to Sports Community Radio with your hosts, Steve Pellis and Joe Novella, another Sports Community digital production, courtesy of www.sportscommunity.com.au. Okay, welcome back, everyone. You're with Joe and Steve here on Sports Community Radio, hosted in the beautiful studios of RPP FM 98.7, 98.3 FM on your dial, the voice of the peninsula. As mentioned at the top of the show, we have got a fantastic guest that we're just about to introduce to you all. His name is Mark Williamson. He is the race director of the Lawn Surf Lifesaving Club Pier to Pub event. It's an open water swim, one of the biggest in the world, and it is a fantastic event. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thanks, guys.
Mark, it's Stephen here. Thank you so much for joining us on the show. I've been looking forward to this interview for a very long time. I've been I competed myself in the Lawn Pier to Pub race probably five or six times. So, if you could, first of all, many of our listeners are interstate and international. If you could just tell us what the Lawn Pier to Pub is and how it came about, and then I'll start to set the scene of what it's like.
Sure thing. Well, Lawn is a coastal community on the surf coast, and like all of the coastal communities on the surf coast, it's got a surf lifesaving club. the Lawn Pierce Pub is, its name is very, very descriptive. It's basically, it's a 1.2K swim from the pier around to the beach. And if you were to go past the surf club, you could probably make your way to the pub. It began 35 years ago, and 35 years ago, it was about 100 people. And it kind of took off from an enshrined surf club tradition of, you know, doing a swim to the pier or a swim back from the pier. And in that very first couple of years, people actually would jump off the pier. And if you've never been to Lawn, it's quite a big pier. It's originally a fisherman's pier designed for hauling fishing boats up out of the water. So it was like a good 5 metre drop into the water. But it, as the numbers grew, you know, having lots of people jumping off the pier obviously became a bit unsafe. So ever since then, we've basically done a water start from right beside the pier. And, you know, over time, we've grown from that initial field of a couple of hundred, mostly clubbies, to this year we'll be sitting at about 5,000 swimmers.
Wow. Now, is there any truth to the rumour? As I said, I've swum it at least five times over the last 20 years, and sitting on the beach, you hear all sorts of rumours and stories. Is there any truth to the story that it actually started by a group of guys, I think it was, jumping off the pier and racing to the pub? Is that how, or is it more of the enshrined tradition?
I've actually heard those rumours myself, and I wasn't a Lawn member back then. But, you know, a couple of years ago, we did our 75-year history for the surf club.
Yes.
And that was the rumour that it got enshrined in the history. So I'm going to say it's more or less true.
Yes.
Because there's a history book that says it's true.
Oh, well, if it's written down, then that's... Cause if
yeah,
you, if
exactly.
You, if you write it down, then it's true. So and plus, it suits our story. I mean, the number that I... And I don't know whether this is right or wrong, but the number that I heard was that, you know, the event started with 13 blokes jumping off a pier, and it's now grown to be... You know, 35 years later, 5,000 swimmers. But the swimmers are just part of the story for me. Can you just describe to our listeners what the beach is like? You know, from point to point. Describe the crowd and what's going on the beach, because to me that's just as phenomenal.
Well, we estimate that, you know, every swimmer brings one and a bit spectators with them on average. So basically, we need to get there pretty early to stake out our piece of the beach, and every piece that we don't stake out, you know, because it's our event is always first weekend in January, so yeah, it's the hot time of year. People are, you know, setting up their little shade shelters, and then as the event itself gets underway, we have 20 to 30,000 people on the beach.
Yeah.
Just, you know, all the way along the beach. And particularly as the competitors start to come in, right, you know, down into the water for spectators wanting to watch the event. So, you know, lots of spectators, lots of beach flags, buntings, signage. You know, it's really quite an electric sort of atmosphere.
It is very much. And how far is Lawn from Melbourne? It's a good 180-odd kilometres, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a good 2 hour drive when the traffic's not busy, and on our weekend it's probably a three plus hour drive.
Yes, it is. Now, an event. Well, I mean, that's just phenomenal, and this is why we use the Lawn Pier to Pub open water swim in our training sessions so much. Because if we think about just what's been achieved in 35 years, I mean, 13 blokes jumping off a pier, or a group of guys jumping off a pier to an event which is the largest open water swim in the world, is my understanding, and it gets 25,000 to 30,000 people lining the shores to watch. Really, open water swimming is not a real flash spectator sport, but it's a phenomenal experience for everyone that comes. And now people are just traditionally coming year on year to the swim.
Well, look, that's right. In fact, quite a few years ago now, we started a club called the Shark Bait Club. And to become a member of that, you need to do 10 or more swims. And largely, the benefit of being in the club is that you can say, oh, yes, I'm a Shark Bay member. And we have some people that have, you know, completed their 10th, some quite a few that have completed their 20th.
Yes.
And a select few that have completed their 30th swim.
Wow.
So, you know, I think once the open water swimming bug bites, it can bite really quite hard. But I think the other thing that makes the lawn swim so awesome is it's kind of one of those things that a lot of people want to do. Just the once, they kind of want to go, yes, I did the lawn swim. And because lawn has a really good reputation for being a, you know, a nice, safe, relatively flat ocean water swim, well, most years, yeah. You know, it's pretty good for people that are graduating maybe from being, you know, a decent pool swimmer into wanting to do an open ocean swim. You know, that's a tough transition for a lot of people.
I can attest to that.
And, you know, it's good to be able to do it somewhere where sea's being particularly nice to you.
Yeah, I agree. What do you think? I mean, if I take my own personal circumstances, I live in Mornington, so to get to Lawn, I need to drive past maybe 30 Bayside and surf clubs that are offering exactly the same swim at varying stages during the year. A 1.2-kilometre open water swim where you kind of get kicked in the face for, well, for me, half an hour while you try and make it to the end. But why do you think it is that people like me that will drive past all the other surf clubs just to come and experience the Lawn Pier to Pub?
Well, look, I don't actually think there's any one single answer to that. I think, you know, we create a great atmosphere on the day. We've got some really good organisation. Obviously, we've got 5,000 swimmers, so compared to some swims, we have to be a bit, you know, militaristic in you know, queuing people into groups and getting them into the water at the right time, those sort of things. But all of that goes to creating quite a, you know, a vibrant atmosphere on the day.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that really helps. I think, of course, you know, you say that you bypass a whole lot of swims, but you know, once the swimming bug's bitten you, you might be going, well, for my summer, every second weekend I'm doing a swim somewhere.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. It's massive. If you've got 5,000 swimmers in the water, not at any one time, but 5,000 swimmers in the water and 20 to 30-odd thousand people, and that is genuinely no exaggeration, it's a massive logistical event. How does the surf club go about doing it year on year? Like, have you got a process or a policy manual? Have you got paid staff that work on it, or kind of take us through how a club, a volunteer run club, has managed to put on one of the, well I think one of the premier sporting events in the country.
So I guess, you know, the planning for our event starts pretty much the day after the event finishes. We start planning for the following year. You know, so one of our traditions is quite soon after the event we'll have a debrief about, you know, what worked, what didn't work, what we could do better, how we could improve things. And then we start, you know, going through organising for the following year. Now, of course, like all repetitive events, we do a whole lot of things the same every time.
Yeah.
But each year, you know, we make a very active set of choices about looking for what can we do to improve our swim, because I think if you're not you know, actively improving your event, then over time it will become stale and old, and people won't want to come to it anymore.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. But how in the planning stage, I mean, I guess, how do you break down the logistics? And to one degree, for me, looking at the swimming part of the event logistics looks to be, without trivialising it, it almost looks to be the easiest part, because there's so many things to take into consideration. Where is 30,000 people, or, you know, 15,000 cars going to go? How do we get people to and from the start point? Their equipment, their clothes, their towels, their, you know, safety, and I definitely want to talk about safety separately, but those are, you know, event logistics that relate to large crowds. Is that all pulled into the same planning process, or?
Look, absolutely. You know, we work very closely with, you know, police, ambulance, the Country Fire Authority, the local council, the people who run the coastal strip, who are known as the GORC, the Great Ocean Road Coastal Committee,
yes,
and Parks Victoria, Marine Safety Victoria. There's quite a few instrumentalities who we work pretty closely with. We, you know, and because there's a lot of stakeholders, you know, we have a fairly extensive set of plans and procedures, you know, from how we'll do things on a good day when everything is running really well, to what will happen if there's an emergency, to, you know, what will happen if there's, I don't know, a really big emergency, like, I don't know, let's say an invasion of jellyfish or
yep,
some unexpected event like that. So we've basically pre-planned lots and lots and lots of those scenarios, and we go through a whole process, you know, running into our event of, well, you know, are we good to go? Are we safe to run the event? And that really carries on right through the end of the event.
So from a community involvement, it looks to me as the outsider that there's a large number of, apart from the organisations that you mentioned, there's a large number of community groups involved in the running of the day, or the, I guess it's really a weekend now, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. We have a run for 2,000 people on the Friday before the swim, so there's a, you know, a couple of days of events going on. And yeah, we try to involve lots of, particularly the local lawn community. So, you know, we have relationships with the football club who provide meals, and the local school who runs quite a lot of the car parking, and, you know, that's a fundraiser that they have. We for many, many years have had a relationship with the Rotary Club of Highton, which is a Rotary Club based in Geelong, and they've done all of our on-the-day registrations, you know, handing out your race kits and your T-shirt and your race cap and all of those sort of things.
Yeah.
And we quite like the fact that, you know, we can share the love around, as it were.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it also gives you some, you know, hands on the, or feet on the ground, doesn't it, which you probably wouldn't necessarily have just in the club membership.
Well, on the day, we think we have about 500 volunteers. And, you know, for our club, it's the one compulsory, if you're a club member, you need to be down there helping on that day.
Oh, so that's a compulsory day for club members.
Yeah, yeah. Because particularly, and we will talk about water safety in a bit, that's obviously one very important aspect. But, you know, there's an enormous amount of infrastructure to be set up,
yes,
taken down, packed away. You know, if something needs moving, well, we've got to have people to be able to move it. You know, all of that sort of logistics stuff and crowd control and, you know, medical emergencies and all of those sort of things that we need to be able to manage.
What about assistance from other life-saving clubs? Is it just equipment that you borrow, or do you use or get assistance from the volunteers of surrounding life-saving clubs?
Yes, we do. So particularly for the water safety aspect, we want to have a lot of IRBs, the inflatable rescue boats.
Yes.
So we try to have far in excess of the recommended number of those, so that if there was the need to rescue a lot of people very quickly, we'd have the capability.
Yes.
So we hire crews and boats from other clubs.
Oh, okay, yep.
And generally, there's a reciprocal arrangement.
Yes.
You know, when they have an event, we'll provide a boat or two to their event.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So let's talk about risk first of all in the water. At the start of the day, what's the process to decide whether the event will even go ahead on the day?
Well,
or the preceding days, I guess.
That's kind of a multi-layered thing. Lawn is really, really good, except if there's an easterly.
Yes.
If there's an easterly, it can be really quite rough. And so that would be our first decision point. You know, if a howling easterly is blowing in and there's waves all the way to the horizon, that's it. The event has been cancelled. We've had to do that twice in our history.
Yes.
To date. Never happened to me as a race director, and I feel every time I talk about it, I'm tempting fate.
Yes, yes.
But that would sort of be our first decision point.
Is that a not negotiable?
That would clearly be a not negotiable.
Yeah.
When you see Lorne with an easterly blowing, and you go, we couldn't even identify swimmers, so how could we keep them safe?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Then I guess the next decision point is one that we have about half an hour before race start.
Yes.
Which is we get our water safety team, our medical team, somebody from representative from Life Saving Victoria, myself, and a couple of the other key people to go, okay, do we have a start in place? Do we have water safety in place? Do we have timing in place? Is all the bits of the, you know, is medical in place? All the event, bits of the event, are they ready? And then we make the go, no-go decision.
Are you running down a formal checklist at this stage, or...?
Yes, yes. So at this stage, we have a minute-by-minute running sheet. And, you know, I basically walk around all that day going, right, are we up to date with our running sheet?
Yeah.
That's a very formal process. It's, in part, it's a sign-off from Life Saving Victoria, but it's also a sign-off from all of our organisation to go, yes, we think we can do this safely.
Yes. And things go wrong, and one of the things that I didn't realise until something did go wrong is the immense medical support that you've got for the event. And, Joel, I'll just tell a very quick story. My beloved wife and one of our key people here at Sports Community, it was a 16 degree in the water day, and she was halfway through and had an asthma attack, started sinking to the bottom and got dragged out, and she was fine. And they took her to underneath the grandstand, which looked to me to be almost a fully decked out medical centre. And then not long afterwards, so I met her and comfort her and all that sort of thing. And not long afterwards, a swimmer was pulled out of the water, not breathing. And this is many years ago, pulled out of the water, not breathing. And there was the facilities and the people that were there that worked on him for many, many minutes and literally saved his life was just phenomenal. And I don't think many people would understand the infrastructure the medical infrastructure that's in surrounding the event. So
we have an amazing dedicated medical team, many of whom have been coming back for year after year after year. And they run a 14-bed, basically a mini hospital under the surf club.
It's literally got hospital beds, isn't it?
We have hospital beds. We have, heart monitors. We've got lots of the sort of appropriate sort of things. So obviously that's cuts and scrapes at the very mine end are people who have got cold. You know, the water in, just depending on what the weather's been doing, the water can be quite cold in Lawn.
Does it get colder than 16 degrees? I remember being frightfully cold that day. Whoa.
But, one of the risk mitigators that we have for that is we recommend everybody wears a wetsuit.
Yeah, absolutely. Except for Ted Bellew, he doesn't seem to think that that's okay.
Well, no, we even persuaded Ted to wear a wetsuit because we went, hey, by example, we knew he didn't really need one, but by example, we would like community leaders like that to be wearing a wetsuit.
And that's from a health and safety. Geez, I never thought of it from that perspective. Wow. Yeah.
So, we run this fairly amazing medical facility. Plus, we have a couple of ambulances on site and, a good relationship with both the local hospital and the whole Victorian hospital infrastructure.
Yes.
Because, if somebody has, like the person that you saw that was brought out of the water not breathing, they are absolutely going to need to be admitted to an acute care hospital.
Yes.
Even if it's only for observation for a few hours.
Yeah.
Or a few... Actually, don't ask me how long they've been in hospital. I'm not a medical person. But that actually means that they'll need to go by ambulance to at least Geelong, because that's the nearest acute hospital. So there's, you know, we've got to make very, very sure that we've got really good medical planning.
Yeah.
Because Lorne's actually not that an easy place. There's only three roads out of Lorne.
Yes.
And so we don't actually need to have very many badly affected runners or badly affected swimmers before we've got a medical emergency on our hands.
Yeah, yeah. So in the water, how far apart, I mean, I used to almost try and work out how many lifesavers you had in the water and then just count them down as my 30-plus minute journey to do the swim. But it seemed like every 10 metres or so that there was someone in the water that was really supervising the swimmers. And I know for my wife, Shona, that prevented what could have been quite a catastrophic event, let alone for the gentleman that came afterwards. So how far apart, and it's not just in the water because you've got them all around the rock coastline as well.
So what we do is, just to describe to listeners, Lorne, the Lorne course is basically quite rocky, and there's really only two points in the length of the course that you can get to shore.
Yes.
So, you know, our preferred method is, if you're just a swimmer that's, let's say, you've gone, you know, I've just had enough of this, my wetsuit's chafing me, I think I've left the iron on at home, you know, I need to get out of the water, but there's nothing actually wrong with that swimmer.
Yes.
Then there's one place we can drop them off halfway along, and we have a rock patrol that patrols that area, and that's so that, you know, if somebody does hop on shore and then maybe they go, oh, I'm not feeling so good, that there's some medical assistance right there for them.
Wow, yes.
But what we basically do, to come back to your question, we line the inside of the course with people on surfboards.
Yes.
And then the outside of the course is where we have all of our rescue boats. So if a swimmer's in trouble, basically one of the boat paddlers can paddle up and either just give the swimmer something to rest on, because for some people all they need is just to catch their breath for a little bit and then they're off.
Yes, yeah.
But the next thing that the board paddler can do is actually, you know, put their board across the course to create a little bit of a breakwater, as it were, and an IRB can come in and pick the swimmer up. And typically, if they're a swimmer in distress, we'll just take them straight to the beach, because that's where we've got our medical facility and that's where they can get the quickest and best care.
Yes.
So, your strategy of counting surfboards is a good one, but what we tend to do is we tend to put a lot of our resources in the first third of the course.
Yeah.
Because counterintuitively, that's where most people pull out.
Well, okay.
So they're really, you know, let's say a not very strong swimmer that's maybe, you know, got a few mouthfuls of seawater and starting to have a pretty miserable time, they'll pull out quite early.
Yeah, they've worked out they've bitten off more than they can chew.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas once people get over halfway, you know, the beach is starting to look closer and closer, so they keep on going.
Yeah, I've never had that feeling.
So, you know, what we then try and do is basically space out our rescue resources for roughly the profile we know of where people pull out.
Yes, yeah. Now, so the format of the day, I think one of the other absolutely phenomenal parts of the day is that us mere mortal amateurs get to swim with, but more watch close at first hand, the elite. So I know the race record is somewhere between 10 and 12 minutes at the moment, is it?
You know, I should know this exactly. It's 10 minutes and some second.
Yeah.
Which was set last year. We had a absolutely phenomenal year last year weather-wise, so...
Yeah,
And made for some very good record times.
And you've had some of the you know, the greatest swimmers in Australia. Daniel Kowalski just springs to mind coming there. So you've got the elite swimming, you've got us mere mortals, but then you've also got the celebrity events as well. So it really is a tremendous day, isn't it? I mean, that's part of the attraction of it. Typically, you know, the Geelong footballers getting in there and getting amongst it.
That's right. You know, And people love that. They love that, you know, they can rub alongside, you know, their sporting heroes or even sporting anti-heroes.
Yep. Well, and it brings everyone, doesn't it? Like, as you mentioned, Ted Bowyer, the ex-Premier of Victoria, has done many, many peer-to pubs, as has done many high-profile people over the journey. It's an amazing crowd, really, isn't it?
Well, that's right. You know, our youngest swimmer is 12, and our oldest swimmer is well into his 80s. Eric Kennedy, I can't remember Eric's age just off the top of my head, but you know, he's been in our legends category for quite a few years now, and that's for people who are over 70. So, you know, there's a huge spread of ages and abilities and, you know, first-timers through to many, many-timers.
Yeah.
And that's part of what I love. And also love the fact that, you know, we've got the capability to help athletes with a disability. So we have a lot of partially disabled athletes who swim the event.
Yeah,
and I get a lot of satisfaction out of making sure that our event's inclusive like that.
Oh, that's one of the things I was going to talk about was the amazing diversity within the group, and it's and certainly people with disabilities is they're often the people that get the biggest cheer coming up the beach, and you turn around and look at who's coming up and why the crowd cheers, and it's often a mighty roar. Really, just reciprocating the mighty effort that some people have gone through to finish the swim. One of the other, I mean, there's the event's just got these whole host of little traditions, and one of the traditions, and you talked about veterans, is at the starting, well, not the gate, but at the starting pier, as you go to walk down into the water, Jay, there's a they go in waves of about 100, is it?
No, about 300.
About 300, yeah. It's about 250 kicks in the head I get. And then...
you should swim a bit wider.
Sorry?
You should swim a bit wider and be less kicks in the head.
I can't, because I can't. By the time I get the rope goes down and then you walk down, then I can't swim out far enough in the 2 minutes that you've got to before your wave starts. But just before you step down to the pier and down the jetty, and all I'm thinking of at that stage is, gee, I hope I don't slip. Joe, you met with one of the legends of Australian sport, which is Brownlow medalist Neil Roberts, just giving everyone a little bit of a... encouragement as they go into the water, which is, I think, it's just a fantastic little tradition.
Yeah, look, we you know, our start team are pretty awesome, and they've got their patter down after, you know, doing it for quite a few years. But you know, one of their sort of roles is to, you know, encourage people.
Yes,
because you know, some people are just absolutely looking forward to it, and of course, some people, well, they're a bit nervous.
Some people are actually at the starting gate thinking they may have needed to do just a fraction more preparation than they probably put in to that point. Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, from the other side, I mean, that's the in the water side and the event logistics. But from a, I guess, commercial point of view, like the event has got, like, it's got mainstream sponsors that peak sporting bodies would be absolutely chuffed to have as sponsors. I mean, you go there on the day and there's helicopters flying over carrying different banners of different sponsors. And how do you go about creating those relationships? Is that done through the club, or do you use professional expertise there? Or?
No, that's up till now, we've been exceptionally lucky in that we've had some awesome sports marketing managers who have come from within the club, and they've done a magnificent job. We've had a great relationship with GMHBA for a number of years now as our principal sponsor, and they've really been a fantastic sponsor to have. A lot of our relationships are really quite long standing, which I think says two things. It says that the sponsor's getting value out of the relationship.
Yes.
And obviously, we're getting value out of the relationship, and I think that's the thing that you need to make a good sponsorship deal. Is there's no point in sort of assuming that you will rock up and you know somebody will give you $20,000 or $50,000 for sponsorship, and you won't have to do anything.
Yeah, those days are gone.
We make a huge effort to make sure that we look after our sponsors very carefully, that, you know, we're looking after their signage, we're treating their brand really well, we're making sure that, you know, all the things that happen are within their brand guidelines. Like, to give you an example, we have an alcohol supplier, and we print different T-shirts for our juniors so that the juniors don't have the alcohol brand on the T-shirt, and the adults do. And that's just, you know, one of the little things that one of our sponsors wanted, so we make sure that that happens.
And well, just speaking of tradition, you just mentioned another tradition, which is the T-shirt. The T-shirt and the image that's on the T-shirt, that's come to a life of its own now, hasn't it, really, that process?
Oh,
to get
absolutely.
You know, collector's piece.
Every year we spend a huge amount of effort to, A, design a good T-shirt, and then, you know, choose colours that are, you know, fashionable, and, you know, we offer that in quite a huge range of sizes. So the logistical effort of T-shirts is mammoth.
Yeah, well, it is when you're thinking about giving a T-shirt to all 5,000 odd competitors. It's absolutely huge, isn't it?
Well, that's right. 5,000 competitors, 500 volunteers, team leaders. You know, all of whom end up with the same T-shirt, but maybe in different colours. You know, a range of sizes, both for men and women. There's a lot of aspects. And I think it's awesome because, you know, the number of people that will come into the surf club where we've got a display of all the T-shirts, and I go, yeah, got that one. Oh, I don't remember that one.
Yeah, they collect them. I've not thrown out any of mine from, I don't know why I don't throw them out, because some of them are 20 years old, but I haven't thrown my ones out because for some reason I feel the need to keep it, which is...
Well, I think they're a very nice tangible memo of doing the event.
No doubt, and it's not something everybody can do, so it is nice to tick it off the bucket list if you only do it once, but it is also nice to be part of the tradition year on year. It's a phenomenal event, and it's something that the Lifesaving Club is obviously very, very, very proud of, and it's an amazing, amazing example of what can be done when a group of volunteers come together with a goal and a vision.
And, of course, I think one of the things that it's really important for anybody that's listening that's thinking about an event is to think, well, okay, so we had 13 guys jumping off a pier. How did we get to 5,000? Because that, you know, that wasn't a single, single jump. So I think very early on, one of the things that we were really lucky to get is we had a volunteer from Highton Rotary who saw that we were running an event and said, well, I could do your registration for you. And he looked after a paper-based registration system for many, many, many years. So that was probably one of the, you know, the first things that was really good about our event, is you knew you could enter and, you know, your entry would be correct.
Yes. So how did you market and grow the event year on year? Or was it literally word of mouth, or how did that happen?
The first few years was word of mouth. Plus, in the early days, we partnered with Eon FM Radio. And sorry to put somebody else's brand into your radio show.
No, that's all right. But
actually laughing. Really, very effective.
You remember Eon FM. Most of our listeners wouldn't remember Eon FM, but they're preceding the Fox Triple M days.
That's right. and so quite early on, we forged that relationship and also our relationship with the Sunday Herald Sun.
Of course,
gave us some really quite good publicity. Also, because a lot of our swimmers come from the Surf Coast, you know, we have a good relationship with the Geelong Advertiser, and you know, we're always trying to provide them with, you know, nicely packaged material that they could use. And I think we're lucky because, you know, our event in the Christmas period, and so we can get a few stories in that period of time. Because it's always a bit light on news, so
yes,
everybody loves a good sports story.
What about your use of social media from the club's point of view through the event and leading up to the event. Is that something that you use much of, or is that part of your strategy, or not?
Oh, look, absolutely. We've got quite a strong Facebook and Twitter strategy, probably more leaning towards Facebook than Twitter. We also, you know, have a fairly extensive email-based campaign that we utilise to communicate with all our competitor base.
Yeah, and you must have quite a significant database now, with kind of 35 years of being able to collect and manage the emails. And I think for me, the emails is one of the reasons that I keep going back, because I think you might send maybe 3 or 4 or 5 out a year, and it just reminds me of the event, and then reminds me when registration's out. And now that you're not automatically registered, you've got to go into a ballot, that kind of creates that sense of urgency as well. So how important is the email database?
Oh, look, that's tremendously important. I think that's a huge marketing tool for us. You know, we're able to get to everybody that's from our event in the last 2 or 3 years and communicate with them, remind them that, you know, either the event's coming up or registration for the event's coming up. And, you know, our registration system also, you know, does lots of things like going, hey, you were successful in the ballot, go and pick up your ticket. And, you know, hey, we see you still haven't picked up your ticket, we'll remind you again. Those sort of things.
So it's doing a lot of the work automated for you now. So
yes.
Very clever. Well, Mark, we could talk all day on your event, because there's so many different angles. And look, what we'd love to do is get you on straight or relatively soon after this year's running. So just give us the details of the event this year and how the listeners can find out more about it. Obviously, they can't enter now because it's closed, but how they go about entering or getting on the... into the ballot for next year. So how do they get in touch with the swim and find it?
So the very first port of call would be the Lawn Surf Club site, which is lawnsurfclub.com.au. And there's a wealth of information about the event and how to register and all of that sort of thing. Our event this year is on the 10th of January, on the Saturday.
And the run's on the Friday night?
The run is on the Friday night, yeah. So... the run is on the Friday morning.
Friday morning?
Yeah, we used to have our run at night, but yeah, we moved it to the morning because it's cooler and safer.
Yes, I remember doing the run on the Friday night, and then the swim on the Saturday, thinking, why did I do the run? But, yeah. So, and Facebook and Twitter?
Facebook and Twitter, yeah. There's Lawn Pier to Pub is on, GMHBA Lawn Pier to Pub is on Twitter. On Facebook rather, so you can go find us on Facebook.
Yeah, and also the GMHBA Mountain to Surf Fun runs there as well on Twitter.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, well, fantastic. Now, Joe, you look like you were going to have a question, which is, this is pretty relatively kind of consistent with his style, Mark, that he will... contributes just sparingly to the interviews, but Joe, you were going to say something?
I was, actually. I was going to... I'm just intrigued as how you keep your volunteer workforce motivated, because one of our... one of the main challenges that we get faced, or our listeners ask us all the time, is how do you encourage volunteers to turn up and support the club? Now, I know you make it almost mandatory, but that's still, you can't whip them to go there. So what kind of things do you do to make sure that you get a huge turnout on the day?
So, look, we have a whole lot of things that we do. We'd start off every year. The surf club runs a bronze camp, which is the very first sort of certificate that you can get in surf lifesaving, so you can actually be a surf lifesaver. We'll run a camp for about 60 people. One of the things I'll do is I'll go down and talk to that camp and, you know, extol the virtues of the Pier to Pub and what sort of things those new surf lifesavers could expect to do on the day. We, you know, on the day, we try to look after our volunteers particularly well. We have a, you know, an after-match function with you know, a barbecue up at the surf club and some drinks for the people that are old enough. And, you know, we try to do a few things of giving people awards of really of encouragement and participation.
So basically, when they sign up as a volunteer, there is an expectation that they will be contributing on event days.
As a member.
That's right.
Yeah, okay. Okay, and I think that's probably a clarifying difference for a lot of clubs out there, that there's very, very strong cultural aspect of surf life-saving, that once you become a member, you're expected to contribute to the club's events. So really important. It's just a sensational event. So I think we're going to wrap that right up there now, Mark. I just want to say thank you. I mean, I don't contribute very much, as Steve said, but it's all quality on my part, and I've just got to say it's quality on your part as well. It's fantastic.
Well, look, thank you very much, guys. You know, there's nothing I enjoy more than talking about this event. I absolutely love it, as you can possibly tell, and you know, it's probably best that you're winding up, because I would just go on talking forever.
Oh no, and we've really appreciated it. We travel the width and breadth of the country, literally, and one of the things that we look for is events and I guess role model clubs, and the Pier to Pub to me is second to none in an event around the country. So to you and your club, congratulations. We'd love to have you on the show relatively straight after the event next year, early February. And
I'd love to be on the show, so let's lock that in.
That would be fantastic. So, Mark Williamson, Race Director, Lawn Surf Life Saving Club, Pier to Pub, Open Water Swim, 10th of January, Lawn. Get down there, but give yourself plenty of time to get there. Thank you very much, Mark, for your time.
Thank you, guys.
You're listening to Sports Community Radio with your hosts, Jonah Vella and Steve Pallas. If you've missed a couple of our episodes, why not visit our website at www.sportscommunity.com.au, and there you'll find all our previous podcasts that you can download. And while you're there, give us a review so you can help spread the news about Sports Community and its services to the grassroots sports clubs. Okay, we've come to that time again where we're closing on the end of the show. We hope you've enjoyed the podcast this week. We've brought to you some great guests, Mark Williamson from the Lawn Pier to Pub race, and also some great news from the world of grassroots sports. If you've missed it or you'd like to hear this podcast again, you can go to Stitcher Radio, or you could go to Podbean, or you could go to iTunes, or you could go to the direct link for the podcast on our website at sportscommunity.com.au. So once again, on behalf of myself, Jonah Vella,
and me, Steve Pallas, thank you for making us part of your sports community.